would find their way home by the scent, by the warmth of their favorite things. The family will eat the physical items later. The spirits just want the gist. We saw all this on dizzying display in Mishkeek, whose massive cemetery was alight with candles, stuffed to the brim with marigolds, and populated by those who'd lost someone. They wore shawls and sat, not unhappily, near the graves of family members they'd known and loved. It was an overwhelming feast for the eyes. The streets were crowded with massive ceramic pots filled with candies and stews. There were nopales, sugar skulls, and, for one reason or another, an actual yak wearing an embroidered saddle and flowers roped around its horns. It was as if all the familiar items from Abuela's house had been blown up to cartoonish proportions. We brought a photo of Abuela when she was young. She wore a red velvet dress and a choker and smiled serenely. There was a public space, a collective altar, where you could leave photos of deceased family and friends. As the elder text of Pixar's Coco teaches, photographs are an important part of an ofrenda. But I hesitated. Abuela had always spoken lovingly of Mexico, and specifically of Mexico City. "You go there and everyone's wearing a suit, mijo," she told me when I was a kid. "Everybody works." I later found this to be untrue, but that's how it existed in her mind. "We climb the pyramid," she told me. "You can see eagles in the tops of the clouds." She was buried in Texas, but leaving her photo here, in Mexico, at the altar, did make it feel like her resting place. What right did we have to be doing this? This was Halloween season to us, not Dia de Muertos. Did Abuela really love Mexico, or did she just enjoy conjuring the idea of some other place, some not America, as a method of escapism? Maybe the fantasy of it all had been a bomb, a medicine. And maybe this fantasy didn't have much to do with this place, with actual Mexico. But maybe there is no actual Mexico. Mexico, like the United States, like any country, is engineered, drawn up, and invented. The older I get, the more I sour on identifying with these kinds of myths and legends. Even Dia de Muertos has become a nationalistic affair, with the Mexican government pouring money into it to attract tourists. This, after centuries of neglecting the indigenous peoples who originated the traditions. There was a fake Dia de Muertos parade in the 2015 James Bond movie Spectre, and the next year the federal government created a real one that's now held annually. It's pretty cool to look at, actually. The point is, I didn't want to be lured into a false sense of nationalism by the siren call of tradition. I wanted to be respectful, to appreciate everything the celebration symbolized, to find something genuine in it. I left the photo of Abuela at the altar, and I felt like I had done something important, something healing. I continue to make caldo de pollo, although I'm sure it isn't the one Abuela made. I like to actually chop things up rather than throw them into a pot like a cartoon witch making a potion. It does lose some heartiness in the process, I think, but it's something I feel I need to do. And when it comes to healing, that's the important part. The private rituals that affirm, I want you to feel better. I also make an altar every year now for Dia de Muertos, as another kind of medicine. 3. Capirotada. Sure, Abuela didn't teach me any recipes, or anything about food, really. And after I witnessed her eat the bread pudding she'd prepared for herself, it's a miracle I ever let her feed me again. I was in the living room while she was eating it and watching her telenovelas. She caught me ogling the bowl and invited me to come closer. The dish is called capirotada, and I've only tasted it once. I will probably never taste it again, and anyway, Abuela took that recipe with her. One thing she did teach me about, though, was poverty. She'd been one of 11 kids and was born and raised in a Texas barrio. But I didn't catch that part, since I didn't exist back then. Abuela's poverty, as I knew it, was her rundown house in Cache, Oklahoma, which was a pretty rundown town to start with. Here's what I know about poverty, thanks to Abuela. It is not merely the state of not having. It is not entirely defined by lack. Poverty is a restless thing, like ocean waves, which are at times calm and at times violent, but always, always threatening to consume, to sweep away. One day you might wake to find everything you've set down on your shore has been carried off. And so poverty is about building against the prospect of devastation every day, poverty is a full-time job. This was the case for my abuelos in their rickety house, which sometimes had no electricity, sometimes was heated by a wood-burning stove, and never, not in all the years I knew it, was completed. There was always some wall to be repaired, some door that needed rigging, some errant piece of wood that was rotting out and needed to be replaced. There was always some screw that could be turned a few more times to tighten up the project of getting by, to keep things from falling apart. The house itself often creaked and groaned, complaining. This is the daily prompt of poverty: hunger, rot, and repair. And Abuela responded to it with gusto and ingenuity. She never wasted a second or a scrap. She'd make us eggs and, without thinking, throw the shells into a pink plastic tub for mulch, which would feed her garden, where she grew peppermint and jalapenos and aloe vera, which in turn would be put to their own uses. Whenever we went out to eat, she'd wrap everything we didn't finish up in napkins, like a spider cocooning its prey, and bring the leftovers home to feed her cats, or her plants, or herself. But usually her cats. She had so many cats. To me, wealth and comfort are defined by waste. The notion that if something doesn't bring pleasure, or if all the possible pleasure has been squeezed out of it, then it can be tossed. Abuela didn't allow for waste of any kind. Everything could be reused. Everything could be repurposed. Everything, the whole world, was made out of useful things. My store-bought Halloween ghost costume from the fourth grade was made out of a silky fabric that she refashioned into a nightgown. This made her look kind of like a specter at night, and she did terrify my high school friends when she came downstairs in it to tell us to shut up one time. As for me, I stood on the shore of poverty with my abuelos for a few hours at a time before rinsing off my feet and going back to my life of excesses, like air conditioning and the internet. Before we were divided by skin color or by Spanish, we were divided by this. My abuelos had to struggle every day, and I did not. The result was a deep chasm that no amount of time spent together could close. At the end of the day, we didn't just speak different languages. We lived in different realities altogether. I don't think Abuelo minded this, really. He was proud of this sort of thing, and he, like many Mexicans in the United States, was a true believer in America. He loved the military, and he loved the vague idea of entrepreneurship. He loved his own narrative of coming from nothing and working hard to make his way up. In a country that depends on dreamers to sustain itself, he was the genuine article. But Abuela was different. Sure, she believed in America to a certain extent, but she had a bitter streak born out of ancestral stubbornness. My belief, which I'll never be able to corroborate, is that her pride, a frivolous but deeply entrenched thing, found itself in conflict with her more practical mind, the one that told her to busy herself with assimilating so her family could make it. This conflict manifested in barely concealed contempt. Sometimes, while my sister and I were playing in her house, she'd sneer and say, "You're both spoiled rotten." Once, on a particularly poisonous afternoon, she told us, "I loved my daddy even if he didn't give me nothing," implying we only loved our dad because he had money. Our father was frequent collateral damage in these skirmishes. He was always, always on business trips, which made it easier to pin things on him. And Abuela was an expert in burying larger, more substantial attacks in small ones. There were occasions where it seemed like Abuela was motivated by revenge or contempt of some kind. One example has been lodged in my brain. It happened during one of our many trips to Wichita Falls, Texas, where we'd order a box of Church's fried chicken and take it to Lucy Park, a small, leafy area with pecan trees. We'd collect pecans to bring home and play on the ropey swinging bridge that stretched over a narrow, murky river bend. Calling it a river might be a stretch, actually, but there it was. My sister and I were playing there on a hot summer day. The sun was burning the nape of my neck, and I was holding on to the creaky swinging bridge with both hands while Abuelo shook it and made monster noises. My sister and I screamed exaggerated screams, and then we ran to Abuela, who was sitting near another Mexican woman. The woman was a young mother watching her daughter, who couldn't have been more than 5 or 6. She made idle talk with Abuela in Spanish. Meanwhile, her little daughter was trying to coax a duck nearer to her, rubbing her fingers together and cooing. The duck was disinterested and very busy with being a duck. But the girl was determined, leaning closer and closer toward the bird bobbing on the surface of the water. she overextended herself, and in the blink of an eye, she fell in. The splash was not as violent as it could have been. It seemed the water had simply accepted her as some kind of offering, and she was gone in a muted plop. "Mi hija!" her mother screamed, and immediately set upon finding her, digging through the brown water like they were sheets of rumpled silk. "Mi hija!" It felt like forever, that moment, because I thought I might have just seen someone die. In those hopeless seconds, even at my young age, I bet on the brutality of life. The water would not be giving the girl back. But then, a thrashing on the surface. The daughter was okay. It was as if the water had relented and brought her back of its own volition. She had all but disappeared mere moments ago. Her mother hoisted her up by her underarms. She was sputtering and coughing, her long black hair slicked down over her face, but alive. I was watching from behind Abuela, feeling apart from myself, the way you do when you witness something almost impossible. But Abuela snapped into action, seizing on some path that was obvious to her. She hustled me over to the car, her hands gruff and annoyed. Her frustration seemed to stem from my not cooperating, not immediately understanding what had to be done. But I didn't know. I was confused. I cried. "Abuela, where are we going?" She set me in the back of the car and removed my clothes, pulling my shirt up and over my head and snatching it away. I wasn't being undressed so much as stripped, some palpable vindictiveness in the way Abuela was going through the motions. She muttered in Spanish under her breath, gathering my clothes in her arms and slamming the door behind her. From the window, I stared out through bleary eyes, watching Abuela dress the girl who'd fallen in the water. I understood. I was dry and she was not. I was a boy and she needed help. And in these situations, boys ought to help out. But now I also understood something else. The contempt, the corrective bitterness in the way Abuela had gripped me, the unspoken bond she shared with this mother and child we'd never met. It was different from the one we had. Not necessarily deeper or stronger, but different. It hurt me. It informed me. I had a similar moment of understanding the afternoon when I first tried capirotada. It's a Mexican bread pudding, and Abuela had a makeshift version. It epitomized the this and that nature of her daily life. Hers contained store-bought raisin bread, Kraft singles, and mayonnaise, of all things. Things easily found in our fridge and pantry that would not be missed in the least. To say she cooked this dish would be a stretch. She would mix these ingredients in a bowl and eat it. The sight repulsed me. She caught me eyeing the concoction one afternoon, not too long after the Lucy Park incident, our dynamic still feeling a little raw from it. She smiled at me, the kind of grin the devil probably has. "You want to try it?" she asked me as if it were a dare, and out of some desire for self-punishment that persists to this day, I decided to subject myself to it. "Sure," I said. It made menacing squishy noises in its bowl as I poked and prodded with my spoon, looking for the path of least resistance. I've been told there are versions of capirotada that are quite good, but I will never know because I never intend to taste it again, be it in my own kitchen or in some fancy restaurant in Mexico City. The regular, more acceptable version involves brown sugar, cinnamon sticks, cubed French bread, golden raisins, and almonds. Abuela's was some kind of a violent knockoff, culled from things that might otherwise have been wasted, a manifestation of her resolute desire to use every last scrap of whatever came her way. Abuela seemed to enjoy herself in that moment, showing me something from her reality, delighting in the little subversion. This was rare. Most of the time, if anything, she doted on me, albeit in her own strange way. I was the boy. I was the oldest. These facts mattered a great deal to her, as much as they mattered to any card-carrying member of the Mexican Abuela Club. It made me all the more special to her. She did love me, even if love didn't come easy for her all the time. But every once in a while, moments like this. Still, I've never in my life tasted something as awful. 4. Arroz con leche. Madre does not cook. For some, this is merely a fact. For Madre, it's more like a personality trait. She does not cook by accident. It's a lifestyle. At one Thanksgiving dinner we hosted, my cousin asked if the ham was from a restaurant called Rib Crib. Madre bent down and said, with emphasis, "Pre-cooked, pre-sliced, always," which has since become a mantra in our house. It remains unclear if my mom is actually proud of the fact that she can't cook. Sometimes she takes umbrage at my referencing it. "Oh, I've made you things," she'll say. Other times, she seems to delight in the fact that she lacks certain domestic talents. She places most of her energy into aesthetics, decorating, hanging prints and mirrors, things of that nature. We would go shopping together often. She'd pick something out and ask me what I thought, as if I had any clue. This meant that growing up, I ate a lot of fast food. Madre was a busy woman, an underpaid junior high English teacher who cared a lot about her students. She was always grading papers or working on lesson plans or breaking up fights. Then, at the end of the day, she had my sister and me to deal with. McDonald's, Pizza Hut, and Brahms, a deeply Oklahoman establishment that sells ice cream, hamburgers, and groceries all in one place, were the staples of my childhood diet. To this day, Madre could be anywhere in the world, anywhere at all, and would still gravitate toward the nearest Olive Garden as if by homing device. Yes, my mom's relationship to food had some unfortunate side effects for me. To the surprise of absolutely no one, I became quite large. But when I put this fact into the wider context of our family's legacy, I really do appreciate it. I see it as a good representation of our arc. Abuela, born in squalor. My mom, born in poverty. Me, born in comfort. It's the kind of trajectory people write about, the kind of narrative people swear is possible in America. It's the dream, in a way. That isn't why I appreciate it, though, because over time I've become disenchanted with the idea of the American dream. I think this is because I'm spoiled, because I've had the leisure time to think about these things and become critical. This is the case with many things. I'm the one in the family who cares about being Mexican, who digs into the history of a country I never lived in, who reads books about identity and then writes about it. These are all things my family doesn't give a cheeklet about. Authenticity couldn't be less of a concern. They don't care about all the words that could be used to describe them. Brown, Latino, Hispanic, Chicano, Mexican-American, person of color, mestizo, and whatever new term will be popularized the minute I finish recording this. These are the things that I have resolved to care about. I have decided to render complicated what my family has wordlessly agreed to keep simple. Why would I do that? The digging has exhausted me. I'm tired these days of excavating myself. I find myself wanting to throw it away, or let it all stay buried and focus on other things. Because the truth is, I have so little to show for all of this work. I have arrived at conclusions only for them to be undone by an article or a conversation or the epiphanies that come and go. I'm tired of academics, of other writers, of people who, like me, have said, "Let's think way too much about this." People, human beings, can't be entirely understood through these rigid lenses alone. Before the people in my life are any of these terms, we are a family, a history, a shared experience. But I didn't take this into account when I was a kid, or when I was a college student soaking up every last drop of information I could get a hold of about my culture. Back then, I was so obsessed with finding some subterranean truth to my experience, a name, a word, a cohesive identity, something. But as I've gotten older, I've learned to part with this framework. I don't think it matters so much what I am anymore, so long as I live in empathy with others, with people for whom the American dream is either inaccessible or downright violent, the lives that are diminished and exploited to keep the enterprise of America afloat. My mother can't cook. I have no memories of her making elaborate dishes for us, especially not of the authentically Mexican sort. I used to resent this. I used to get jealous of my Mexican friends. Friends whose mothers made them cakes and enchiladas and yet more dishes with names I could neither pronounce nor imagine in my head beyond the basics. Herbs and chicken feet in a red-orange stew, a pungent scent wafting from the kitchen. I wanted these memories because I thought they would legitimize me. But legitimize me as what, exactly? I had no answer for that either, and there aren't enough Spanish classes or trips to Mexico or lectures in the world to give me one. I have learned since to embrace a happy agnosticism over how I formally identify myself. And what's more, I do have foundational memories with my mother, who bought me all the sketchbooks and pencils I wanted, who told me I should be an artist, and who was my English teacher in the ninth grade, first period. We were late one morning because she was doing her hair and she still counted me as tardy. Memories like that. Prominent among these memories is my first trip to New York City when I was 9. I'd never been on a plane before, never seen my hometown shrink into miniature and fade away, and had certainly never seen buildings so tall. Everything frightened me, because of both its size and its gravity. I got anxiety realizing that such important things had been happening so far from me, and my little life back home was a pale non-event by comparison. Maje rented us a limousine, slick, shiny black leather interior with seats that went around in an oval, backlights that were pink, then blue, then green. The whole affair smelled new and exclusive. A man wearing gloves and a cap opened the doors for us, called my dad Mister, and couldn't have driven us more than a few blocks. We slid out in front of our destination, the steps of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. "There," Madre said. "Now you won't have to be impressed by limousines anymore." Mom, Madre, my mother, she can't cook. I'm proud of her for not being able to cook. I think it's great that she can't cook. It reads as a kind of triumph to me. I see it the way she sees her shiny, straight teeth. My abuelos couldn't afford to take her to a dentist, so the second she was able to go as an adult, she requested braces. She still fusses over her teeth and once told me, rather macabrely, "I don't care what it takes, I'm going to die with nice teeth." I was 7, maybe. I've come to appreciate the absence of certain things, because the absence itself is in conversation with a history. Madre didn't make any traditional dishes, nor did she speak much Spanish. But it's a pointed absence, one that means something and has something to say. It is not nothing. Approximately one time, Madre made me arroz con leche, a pot, some white rice, some milk, and some sugar. I can't even place it in my mind, can't recall what I was doing, what day it was, how old I was, or anything. I only know it happened once, even if I can't imagine Madre turning on the stove and making it again. Arroz con leche is a dish that has hopped around much of the world. It was a popular dessert in Spain, where it was made with long grain rice and cinnamon. But they in turn borrowed it from Moorish influences, back when large swaths of the country were being ruled by conquerors from North Africa. It then traveled to Mexico, and then from Mexico to me. I remember more distinctly how it tasted. It was sweet. It was simple. 5. Conchas. The first concha I ever ate was yellow, of all colors. I hadn't seen a yellow concha before, and I haven't seen one since. They're usually brown, white, or sometimes pink. What flavor could that yellow concha, sitting in a panaderia window just outside of Dallas, possibly have been? Well, to me, it was the flavor of happiness. My upbringing with my abuelos wasn't all arguing and discomfort and fevers and unwarranted digs at my existence. Some of it was road trips to Texas in the early morning, when we'd cross the Red River just as the sun started spilling into the sky, my sister and I sitting shoulder to shoulder in the back of their pickup. We'd eat a breakfast of Carl's Jr., crumbly biscuit sandwiches with the top set aside to eat with jam at the end, a delicacy. And then we'd go to the panaderia. I must stress, again, the lack of dietary oversight my sister and I experienced. I've established that my abuelos were poor, but luxury is a relative thing, and my abuelos weren't without their oases of excess. For abuela, that looked like a cup holder of loose change as we rolled up to La Paloma Panaderia, a Mexican bakery in a Dallas barrio not too far from where my auntie lived. We would park, and abuela would fish out the coins. Or on days when she was feeling particularly opulent, she might pull out the Ziploc bag where abuelo kept neatly folded dollar bills and give my sister and me some cash. She would open our hands, place the money in our palms, and close them for us. It was here that I briefly saw the grandmother I think abuela would have liked to be, the kind who spoiled her grandchildren and who thought of herself as overly generous. It was the only moment I thought that abuela might really care how we saw her. In the panaderia, with sticky floors and a whirring fan working overtime in the corner, a dollar is as good as gold. With silver tongs, my sister and I plucked conchas and puerquitos and sometimes things we didn't even know the names of. Spongy cakes with thin lines of strawberry jam in the middle. All kinds of breads twisted into fantastic shapes and dusted with sugar. As pleasurable as the act of choosing, more pleasurable even, was the very beginning, an empty tray and endless possibilities, a canvas to fill with pastels and flavors. Abuelo would loiter by the cash register speaking Spanish to the woman working. It was always a woman running the shop. There was usually a TV perched in the corner, pushing out some scratchy program as best it could. The treats were kept behind sliding plastic windows, sitting on racks tilted toward us, and we'd grab and grab and grab. We'd place our selections on the tray and pay ourselves, but under Abuela's watchful eye. The woman would put our pastries in a small plastic bag, tie it up, and slide it over to us. It was always full to bursting, and I would wonder how we'd ever eat it all. To this day, when I think of happiness, I think of a day like that, of the yellow concha I bought once, the little yellow crumbles at the bottom of the bag, the color of uncomplicated mornings. In the Chicano world, few foods have achieved the status that the concha has. Sure, tacos are a big deal and always have been, but the concha, the sweet bread with a shell pattern on top, has become something of a mascot for Chicanos specifically. I think there are a few reasons why. For one thing, they are immediately recognizable. The concha is not a subtle girl. There's a distinct color palette and pattern to the concha, and if there's one thing Chicanos are hungry for, it's symbols. My theory is that the United States is very good at making people with any degree of otherness feel alienated. I take it a step further, even. Its rugged cult of individualism, mixed with its cultural dominance, a culture so ubiquitous that it often feels invisible, leaves people of all stripes yearning for an identity beyond its borders, something older, nobler, and more interesting. Many white people feel this way, too. It's like an American who's only pretty sure they're of Irish descent, adorning themselves with shamrock tattoos, going way too hard on St. Patrick's Day, and boasting about how they can hold their liquor. People with vaguely Italian last names will log on to Facebook and leave comments on recipe videos like, "My Italian ancestors gasped when they saw her reach for the ketchup." I'm not saying it's a good or bad thing, only that it's a thing. For Chicanos, whose cultural mothership is literally a neighbor to the USA, I think this grasping for identity takes on a more desperate dimension. There is no United States without a Mexico, and it sometimes feels like neither of these two parents are particularly eager to take us in. You will see Chicanos caring about things Mexicans simply don't. We are more likely to get Our Lady of Guadalupe tattooed on the full length and width of our backs, more likely to boast about our family's recipes and bona fides, because we have something to prove. For more evidence of this, I would point you to the cult of Selena Quintanilla. Selena died in 1995, but even young Chicanos know to hold her in esteem, to worship her, in a way, to this very day. This is not just because of her music, although her music slaps. It's because of the way the idea of her helps us to congeal our own identities. She was of Mexican descent, but born in America. She didn't know Spanish growing up, but learned it later. She was curvy and brown, and wore purple glittery bodysuits, which themselves later became deeply embedded in Chicano iconography. She makes it easier to imagine that we are a culture unto ourselves, with our own symbols, our own food, our own songs, our own look, and our own language. Speaking only for me, as someone who used to very earnestly traffic in this kind of sentiment, a lot of it is desperately corny. We don't need constant announcements of how much you love Takis and spicy things and como la flor. A lot of it is, in other words, highly performance-based, the way identity tends to be. But I never begrudge it when I see it now. There's this need, this desire for something, anything, to offer us a blueprint of who and how to be. La Concha occupies a lane similar to Selena's in this regard. We love La Concha. We worship La Concha. We put La Concha in our jokes. We make fan art of it. We reference it along with other Chicano staples, like the dreaded chancla and vapor rub, and those tin cookie cans our abuelas use as sewing supply storage. Before we share a language or race or ethnicity or what have you, we share an imagination. Conchas are also incredibly accessible. They are cheap, they are delicious, and all they require of you is to look at them and then eat them. There is no language barrier to enjoying the concha. Even if you don't speak Spanish, nothing is stopping you from walking into La Panaderia and going to town in there. I would know. This tradition entrenched itself as one of the most distinctly Chicano things my family actually took part in. After I mastered more basic recipes like tortillas, I found myself wanting to make my own conchas. The only problem was they are a kind of bread, and bread is a living, breathing thing. and I am not the most nurturing or careful person alive. At great personal cost to my reputation and my community, I will paint a Lovecraftian picture of my first attempt at conchas. A bubbling, burping hunk of dough that felt heavy as a rock and looked like it might gain sentience and leap out of my hands at any moment. Que será, será. I gave up on making conchas for a while, for obvious reasons, until I went on a trip to Mexico City in 2017 and saw an Airbnb excursion offer. Learn how to make authentic Mexican sweetbread. My white friend in tow, I made my way to a kitchen in the Mexico City suburbs to make mis conchas in a screw-up-free environment. A kind baker named Oliver, bespectacled and certain, guided me through the process. Concha dough is sweet and wet. It has refolded over itself many, many times, more times than I imagined. In the past, I hadn't trusted that the dough was becoming anything while I was kneading it. I had given up too early because I couldn't imagine something so loose and formless becoming something. But making conchas in Mexico City, I folded and kneaded so much that I started to dissociate from the repetition. It was a nice rhythm. Scoop from below, a quick clockwise turn, a slap down on the table, and do it all again. It started to thicken up and become something more recognizable. All it took was trust, patience, and routine. The crunchy top of a concha is basically a cookie or shortbread. It's glued to the top of the sweet brioche-like bread with butter, and then a pattern cutter is gently pressed over it to form the shell shape. That means the top can be pretty much any flavor you want. Vanilla, chocolate, strawberry, cinnamon, matcha. Well, matcha might be kind of gross, but you could try it if you wanted to. It can be whatever you want it to be. I've made many, many conchas since then, and I've tweaked the recipe to make it more my own. For most of my life, I've thought of family recipes as being very old. If they weren't written down on crinkly, sepia pieces of parchment, then could they really be family recipes at all? But I've come to understand that, well, I'm part of a family too. Family recipes can be my recipes. Once I get past ideas of authenticity and obsessing over artifacts and heirlooms, there's nothing keeping me from seeing it that way. I could make an Oreo concha if I felt like it, and it would then become a family recipe. I won't, but such is my power. Actually, that sounds pretty good, and I've written it down. The point is, I am part of a living legacy. I've been shaped by my family's dramas and personalities and pasts as much as I've been shaped by my own desires, motives, and struggles. I have my own language, and I can say whatever I want with it. And for now, I'll say this. If you've never tried a concha before, you really should. 6. Un cafecito. It's common in Latin America to enjoy un cafecito, a little coffee, after any major meal. I don't really get it, as coffee is more of a necessary morning panic attack inducer in my book, but I guess I've warmed to the idea over time. This custom is more of a Puerto Rican and Cuban thing than a Mexican thing, but, as I've said, I don't care so much about that these days. I think un cafecito is meant to extend the evening and create more time to enjoy chatting with each other, and I'm always down to chat. Every family has a history as told by food. When I ask friends about theirs, they usually head straight for their mom's greatest hits, like biscuits or cake or lasagna. But I also hear about plenty of casseroles, hamburger helpers, and Applebee's. We eat, therefore we are. One need not have a professional chef in the family tree to have a culinary legacy. But weirdly enough, my family, of all families, had one, and I can prove it. I've got a crinkled newspaper ad from my great-grandfather's Mexican restaurant in Wichita Falls, Texas, stashed away. Mexico Cafe, it reads. Authentic Mexican food made the authentic Mexican way. Certainly, Mexico Cafe isn't the most creative name in the world, but I guess, like me, he had a point to prove. It feels hard to believe that we would have a chef or cook or restaurant owner in the family, much less one who seemed to care just as much about being Mexican as I do. This was a man who wanted to really pound it through your head that this restaurant was an authentic Mexican establishment. I have no idea what was on the menu or what it looked like on the inside, only that it used to exist near the Luby's cafeteria that my family and I would eat at often. I wish I could have seen it. But in all the stories I've heard about my great-grandfather, whose name was Sotero, it's clear that cooking wasn't actually his passion. He liked music and poetry and fancied himself a Renaissance man. I have a poem he published in my room. It's about Christmas Eve and it's not very good. But I like it anyway. It gives me insight into this man I've never met. I hear him saying, "This is who I'd like to be, if I could." For Sotero, he had to reckon with the fact that Mexican Americans of a certain social class didn't have that many avenues to tread, a situation that persists today. There's food, gardens, things to be cleaned, fruit to be picked, or wars to be fought. My family has walked all of these roads. I imagine that for Sotero, it was Mexico Cafe, manual labor, or the military. He found something in his otherness that could turn a profit. Authenticity, authentic Mexican cuisine made by authentic Mexicans. In Sotero's lifetime, we lost some family members to the Vietnam War. One was Ramiro Alanis, I'm told. He was one of many young Chicanos put on the front lines in Vietnam, where many people were killed. This was common for Chicanos. This war killed so many of us that it spawned the Chicano Moratorium, an anti-war movement that started organizing walkouts in 1968 and hit its peak with a march in East Los Angeles in 1970. The march drew 20,000 demonstrators, mostly Chicano, and was the largest anti-war demonstration by any ethnic group in the United States for many years. It makes sense. They were killing people's sons, sons like Ramiro. His name was etched in the Vietnam Veterans Memorial now. I'm thankful I never felt pressured to be a soldier, or to work in a kitchen, or to garden. It's not that these things are lowly or beneath anyone, more that they are not usually a choice and almost never adequately compensated. In my perfect world, kitchen staff, gardeners, and manual laborers would be paid better than execs, but lo que sea. I've described the Chicano experience thus far as being built around a tangible absence. But I think that absence may actually be pressure. Invisible but perceptible pressure. That's the big, not-so-secret ingredient at the end of the day. Poverty, authenticity, assimilation. These are not merely the lack of money or language or identity. They are pressure. All of them pressure. It's the pressure that shaped us to varying degrees. It made soldiers and dropouts and underpaid teachers and kids with identity crises out of us. How do we remove it? Should we? Can we? Is this just part of being who we are? I'm not so sure we can truly be rid of it. We can't just dress ourselves differently, take great pains to present ourselves differently, and then pretend the pressure's gone. One time, my mom convinced Abuela to get a fancy haircut at the mall on her dime. Abuela came back unrecognizable. Her hair was cut severely and fashionably short. She was wearing a coral halter top with gold-plated jewelry on her hands. She knew how jarring this was to us and made a big show of it, making snooty rich lady gestures and cracking us up. It was funny, but it also broke my heart. I could see so clearly how different Abuela's life could have been. If she hadn't dropped out, if she hadn't been poor, if life had been just a little bit kinder to her, she could have had room for things besides survival and self-preservation. What would she have been like if she'd had comfort and excess? I don't mean anything crazy. Nice clothes, nice haircuts, nice food. She wouldn't have been Abuela then. But I sometimes think of her in that rich lady haircut, and I find myself wishing things could have been different. In any case, it wasn't our path. To me, that's all authenticity is. It's not performing struggle. It's not a specific language or skin color or refusal to stray too far from a recipe or try anything new. It's not railing against rainbow conscious on Twitter or arguing with online trolls about the right way to make tamales. Authenticity is whatever reflects your reality. You'll know it when you see it. You'll taste it when you eat it. It's anything that isn't trying to be anything it's not. And here, in this headspace, I have found my peace. I am what I am. I've got what I've got. When I tell the story of my family, I tend to tell it in the negative. I talk about the things they didn't have, things my parents and grandparents didn't pass on to me. This is, for one, my own culture at play. I love to complain. But it's also distinctly Chicano, or Mexican-American, or whatever you want to call it, an experience that is defined by loss, by the languages you don't speak, by the family members you don't see, by the things you don't eat. I've done it again here, and I'm mostly fine with that. But it's just as important to look at the things you do have, The abundance, the dazzling sights, the happy smells and sounds, whatever's growing in the soil where you were planted. Abundance is relative. You can define it, at least in part. And for me, here's what I did have. The beef muchacho at Taco Bueno in Lawton, Oklahoma. Let us revisit the UNESCO World Heritage Site of the Taco Bueno one last time. The one that used to sit by the IHOP and the Kmart, two American icons in their own right. Abuela is first to dismount from the two-seater pickup we've been stuffed into. My sister and I are still wearing our Catholic school uniforms, navy and white. For lunch, we probably had what can charitably be referred to as a Salisbury steak served on plastic trays in the cafeteria, so we're excited by the promise of quesadillas and chips. It's a fall day with just a nibble of chill in the air. But of course, Abuela is already decked out in her winter shawls. "I'm cold, mijo," she'd often say in the middle of summer. Abuelo comes out next, wearing his veteran's cap with all the pins and badges on it. He runs right into the curb like always, but he got us here sure enough. He's thinking of what story he's going to tell the hapless cashier today. Perhaps it will be the one about how he had to fight off a Russian with a bayonet in the war. It's never totally clear where or when these wars happened. My sister and I step out, the scene of our family unfolding around us. The inside of Taco Bueno smells like cheap meat, aging lettuce, and weak salsa. But these are happy smells. Abuela makes a beeline for the salsa bar while Abuelo has the staff distracted. She takes greedily from it, like a hummingbird flitting about several flowers, unsure which nectar is best and so choosing all of them. My sister and I grab us a table, our favorite one, beneath the mural of the iguana wearing sunglasses. We wait for the cashier to call the number on our receipt, and we ferry the trays full of food back to the table. Quesadillas and tacos and tortilla chips. A feast if ever there was one. I have no way of knowing it, but years from now, I'll wish I could come back here. I'll wish I could sit my fake Mexican rear down in that fake Mexican establishment with a clear mind as I sink my teeth into whatever concoction the geniuses at the Taco Bueno lab came up with. It's not that the food is all that great, or even all that good. It's that it's what's in front of us. It's what we have. It's what we know. And before I know anything else about myself at this age, I know this. We're here, as Abuelo would say. This is what food, at its best, ought to do. It ought to make you feel at home. This has been an Audible original, produced by Audible Originals. Written and performed by J.P. Bramer. Executive producers, Laura Blackman and Chris Sacco. Acquisition and Development, Catherine Stewart. Vice President of Audible Studios, Mike Charzuk. Editor-in-Chief, Audible Original Publishing, David Blum. Copyright 2020 by J.P. Bramer. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.